Thank you very much, Ian. I'm passing around some handouts, so you'll be able to find some of the quotations and other things for this talk. But anyway, this is looking at the people's pensions. I can't see Alf Wilkinson in the room, but he's responsible. He actually specifically wanted a lecture on the centenary of the old age pension, so this is it. So what we have, I think, is that the payment of old age pensions began just over 100 years ago. It was January 1909, and under the Act of the previous year, these pensions were paid out. Some 549,000 people got pensions. They all had to be over 70. And when you start analysing who they were, some 63% of these people getting the pension were women. And you find that if you actually work out the proportion of women in the population who were over 70, you find that they're actually 58.6%. So in other words, women were a high proportion of this group, but they're an even higher proportion of those who were deemed suitably poor to get a pension. And I think that's a very modern theme, you know, that if you want to find poverty in Britain or probably other societies, look for women with longevity and you're going to home in on poverty fairly fast. An unusual feature of old age pensions in Britain, I think, was that it was one of the issues where all the parties, excluding perhaps a few right-wing conservatives, were in favour of pensions. All of them had spoken in some way or another in favour. But the issues, I think, that became very contentious, you know, where the political debates were very much more to do with how you pay for the pensions, whether people contributed to the pension or whether they came straight out of the exchequer. And the final thing, I think, which was controversial, was when did you bring it in? You know, what was the timing of it? So I think these were some of the, you know, the issues that were around about the pensions, not so much whether or not pensions should be brought in by the British state. The controversy about how you paid for pensions, on the whole, sounds to many people boring. But to me, it seems to be almost the heart of this issue. And it was one of the hearts, I think, of Edwardian politics. So I think if you look at pensions and then look at how you pay for them, I think you're getting an insight, which is quite a good insight, into conflict in Edwardian politics. If you take the Conservatives and the Liberal Unionists, with Joseph Chamberlain as the figure who had been the leading figure in the first few years of the century, you find that the way to pay for pensions would have come from tariff reform, from tariffs. And the Conservatives, I think, were faced with a state which was getting bigger in terms of public expenditure. The kind of levels of public expenditure went up after Education Act of 1870. They go up again with the Boer War. And so how do you pay for this? From the Conservative point of view, the answer would be not to tax the rich, not to tax land values, not to do this type of thing, but maybe to find a different way around. And they were looking to Bismarck's Germany. And in Germany, you have the tariffs. And under the Kaiserreich, you have a system where the wealthy landowners were taxed very little, and then primarily on local taxes, whereas most of the funding for the Kaiserreich came from tariffs. Of course, putting tariffs on food meant that in the end, the working class paid disproportionately for the state. And as a result, and probably as a direct result in my view, you end up with the largest socialist party in the world, the SPD. And this, you know, is seen as an outcome of tariffs. So you find that Edwardian politics had the British working class generally in favour of free trade. I mean, this has been a cause through the 19th century. It was a cause which was much more than just about tariffs. It was about, it was envisaged to be about peace, about people who trade with each other wouldn't go to war with each other, and a lot of other things. But the feeling at the end of the 19th century, there was increasing feeling that the old Victorian norms of Gladstone, you know, where Parliament was predominant, those in the rest of the world would do well to look at the British system and admire and emulate, was looking a bit threadbare when you have the competition from the US and from Germany. And so you're beginning to get questions asked about various aspects, I think, of the Victorian norms. And, you know, people were saying, well, okay, you know, before we'd seen British parliamentary democracy and the British Industrial Revolution, the two can't go hand in hand and explain British wealth and exceptionalism. By the end of the century, I think there was less confidence that this was the case. So I find it very interesting that when it came to the welfare reforms, the question was, how would you pay for them? Would you make it contributory? And I think Lloyd George is not the instigator of old age pensions. I mean, they've been knocking around the idea, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But politically, in this government, Campbell Bannerman had been Prime Minister 1905-8. Asquith had been Chancellor of the Exchequer. And these plans were drawn up under Asquith. But Campbell Bannerman goes. He dies within days of leaving office. And Asquith takes over. And it's Lloyd George who pushes these measures, the old age pension, through the House of Commons. And it's Lloyd George who comes up as Chancellor of the Exchequer with the people's budget, facing the big issue behind all this of how do you pay, how do you get extra money for a British state which is now spending money not in a Gladstonian way of frugality and doing little, but now paying money for wanting money for dreadnoughts, wanting money for pensions, and indeed for other costs of the state. And the answer that that Lloyd George comes up with is that he believes he can provide the money for this reform, old age pensions, and other reforms through free trade finance. And I think this is probably at the root of Lloyd George's genius, if you like, in this period. I mean, I'm very mixed on Lloyd George. I can see good points, I can see some very bad points. But the Lloyd George pre-1914, the people's champion Lloyd George, I think the roots of his success lie in his ability to finance old age pensions and other things through free trade finance. Now, saying that usually kind of helps everybody have their after-lunch snooze. But I can go a bit further and make certain you have your after-lunch snooze by saying I think there's an interesting thing that follows from this. And that is that Lloyd George got very interested in Bismarck's system in Germany. Bismarck had brought in certain measures in the 1880s. I'll give you the dates in a moment. But Bismarck's measures had been part of his response as a Junker, a landowner, who didn't like urbanisation, did not like industrialisation, and most certainly did not like socialism and the SPD. And part of the guarantee against these things spreading in his eyes, he was wrong, it didn't stop it at all, was to bring in certain measures of welfare for urban people. So the point I'm about to make, the one which may send you to sleep, you know, is the point that Lloyd George positively went after old age pensions looking at the German system. Indeed, if you actually read the debates on old age pensions in the House of Commons, you can actually see, well, pretty well see, Lloyd George's mind working. And I'll come back to that, how he responds to things as the debates go on. But one of the things put to him by another MP was, why didn't he look at the German system? And he did go and look, and he did, think about it. And being someone who I think once was described as having a magpie mind, i.e. that if he saw any glittering ideas, he would swoop in and seize them and take them off. Lloyd George, goes to Germany and he comes back very impressed. Now, the point for me for this is that Lloyd George, I think, as Professor E.P. Hennock has argued in a book called The German Precedents of Liberal Social Reforms, I think Hennock is right when he says that Lloyd George not only looks at the German system, but he says this is a tariff system. I am representing free trade. I want to do better. And therefore, I think Lloyd George comes back from Germany, he thinks hard, and he is very much determined that his set of reforms are going to be better than German, not just because he doesn't like Germans, but because he wants to outdo tariff reform. So I think the funding of these reforms is fascinating in terms of Edwardian politics. The next big point I'd like to make is about why did these reforms come about? Usually you can read almost any kind of textbook or any general book and you'll get a string of points. And I think most of these are right and I'll no doubt make them in a moment or two. But it seems to me that there's a fundamental point which is always lurking there in the background but not always explicitly spelt out. And that point is the crumbling of the old workhouse system, the belief that you have a system which is deterrent, the idea that you make it that people go in and they're going to get worse treatment than if they could manage outside. Now, that had been the workhouse new poor law of 1834. Any HA member here who has a National Trust card and feels like going to Southall, just north, outside of Nottingham, you'll see the wonderful Minster, and then you can go to Southall Workhouse and you can go round and see the horrors and the lack of dignity for human beings in the workhouse. If you look at the handout that Ian's just taken around and look at the front page, you'll spot that it's not a Ryan Airway, no food, no toilet trip. It's actually a workhouse with rows of people there, women. And I don't think it's chance that it's large numbers of women. As I said earlier, you find that if you want poverty, you want women and longevity. And you'll find that about 60 to 70% of the poor in workhouses would end up being women in the women's bay. Attitudes to the workhouse had changed very markedly over a period. We all know about Oliver Twist and the feeling about orphans. You also would probably know about the problems of treating people ill in the workhouse, i.e. cholera epidemics soon convinced people that you shouldn't punish the sick, you needed to treat them, because these sicknesses wouldn't stay within the workhouse, they would menace everyone. But the other one is the elderly people, and there's a feeling that since many of us in the room have been through the marriage ceremony and the let no one tear asunder those whom God has joined together, to give a gloss on it, the notion of sending people into the workhouse where the old couple were rounded up from their home, put on a horse and cart, and then driven off to the workhouse, the neighbours usually in tears as they went because they wouldn't see them again. And when they got to the workhouse, the men were put in one wing and the women in the other. I mean, this was becoming less and less acceptable. I'm a great fan of Thomas Hardy and always like his bitter humour, and I've put on the back of the sheet The first sheet, we've got the women, one of Hardy's less known poems, which is called The Curate's Kindness, where the old couple are on the wagon going off, and obviously the response one should have is to cry in, with tears about them being split asunder. But being Thomas Hardy, of course, he says, oh my God, you know, now the curate is going to stop this. And he says, the curate succeeded. I will jump off the wagon and drown myself at Pummery Weir, because I thought after 40 years I was rid of her. But that's real Hardy, you know, kind of bittersweet parody of what was happening. But anyway, I think the changes in the workhouse, that it was no longer acceptable, was behind a lot of these reforms of the Edwardian period. A second thing was awareness of things happening elsewhere. Britain, as usual, was fairly slow in all this. Bismarck had brought in measures in 1889 and certain measures around those dates. Bismarck's measures didn't go as far as the British ones, but they still were innovatory and early. But as I say, they were there for a conservative, with a small c, reason. You find that New Zealand in 1898 came in with non-contributory pensions, i.e. handed out free. And that, again, impressed people. But the politics of it, I think, probably kicked off in particular with Joseph Chamberlain. Chamberlain had been the great urban radical of the 1880s, the man of Birmingham. He had been the man seen as the future of liberalism when Gladstone eventually retired, but he had broken over home rule. And you have him with the liberal unionists, not rejoining Gladstone, but, if you like, looking as though they're going to do business with Salisbury and the Conservatives. But for Joe Chamberlain, there was a problem, and that was he represented Birmingham, a big industrial constituency. More than that, in 1891, the Liberals rejigged their programme at Newcastle and came up with a mix of policies. And there was Chamberlain, almost left high and dry as an urban politician, and he takes up old age pensions. But he does it saying that he wants them to be a mixture of both voluntary, i.e. you don't have to sign up for pensions, and that there would be a contributory element, but the state would add something. And Chamberlain got a surprise, because the friendly societies, which had something like 3 million members, didn't like even something like that coming in, because they had a vested interest in collecting money for pensions. The oddity about the friendly societies was that they were financially in trouble by this time. They had the problem that we are all aware of today, and that is greater longevity of people, i.e. people were living longer and longer, and there was a very marked fall in the birth rate in the 1890s and onwards. So they were getting less people to sign up, or they could see this happening, and they were the people they were paying out to were living longer and longer. But even so, the friendly societies at the time of Chamberlain taking up this didn't want the state to do it. And Chamberlain, in effect, backs off. He still airs comments on it. He still sounds off about it, but he's not very serious about it later. But on the other side of the fence, Lloyd George, who was making a name for himself as a Welsh radical, curiously to me, I found him speaking in Wales in 1892, taking this up. He had hero-worshipped Joe Chamberlain when Chamberlain had been in the Liberal Party. And Lloyd George gave his own spin in 1892. He said he didn't like the idea of people contributing to the pensions. And the main critique of people contributing was simply that those who are in desperate need couldn't contribute. In other words, those most needing a pension were the very last people who could contribute. But Lloyd George had a way to pay for it, and this was his speech. Let ground rents be taxed. Let excessive pensions and salaries be reduced. Is that topical? And let the royal family be allowed just enough to keep up their dignity while they are still with us. So this was a radical twist on Chamberlain. And interestingly, in the 1895 general election, Lloyd George came up with it again. This time he's going to fund it from boosting the newly introduced death duties, which the 1892-5 government had done. He was going to do it from the tithe, which of course the Anglican Church, as a nonconformist, is glad to grab their money. And the other thing was more land taxes. And you find that Lloyd George was on a House of Commons select committee in 1899 proposing a 5 shilling pension to all over 65 who had an income of no more than 10 shillings a week. And that was, again, and this is one of the punchlines of all this, but there was a proviso, and this takes you back to my good friend William Gladstone and morality and liberal views, and this was that they would get this pension providing they had not been convicted of a significant crime, they had not been in receipt of poor relief for a given period, and that they could show that they had been thrifty for a substantial period. So you get all the kind of the Gladstonian and workhouse notions that there are two types of poor. There's a worthy poor who you help and an undeserving poor who you deal with sternly. So Lloyd George still has this element there. The other source, I think, of important views on this was Charles Booth, who was the great social survey man. Booth was a ship owner. He had been a liberal, or at least an active liberal, in his earlier years. He funded this massive survey, Life and Labour of London, 17 volumes between 1886 and 1902. And this came out with suggestions which you can interpret various ways, but by and large were taken to mean about 20 to 32% of people were in poverty. This was reinforced by Seebohm Rowntree looking at York and coming up with similar levels. And this was shock horror because it was a pretty cathedral town, not London, which was seen as the sink of the empire, you know, a kind of place you'd expect that. Booth, when you look at what he wrote in those volumes, is very interesting. He does deal with old age. He does see, quite rightly, old age as a major cause of poverty. And he wrote that his books show, quote, "the state of things which I describe in these pages, though not so appalling as sensationalist writers would have us believe, is still bad enough to make us feel that we should not tolerate it in our midst." So he came out and was a cogent speaker at various meetings. He went on royal commissions in favour of old age pensions. Now, the sensationalist writers he did not like were certainly some of the pamphlets of the period, but quite possibly, people argue over this one, but I think very likely to have been H.M. Hindman and the Social Democratic Federation. In other words, these evil Marxist socialists were talking about all this poverty, but this is just kind of socialist rhetoric. I will do a proper survey. And of course, his proper survey, whether it was whatever his motivation, I think it was partly altruism, partly because he was a Comptist and liked the scientific way of looking at things, but I think it was also partly to disprove, you know, wild allegations as he saw them, but his research showed quite otherwise. Quite a few historians write about this and say there's no real sign that Booth influenced people who mattered. All I can say is I've read pretty well every Lloyd George's speech in Wales, and he certainly mentions Booth quite often. I won't say often, perhaps I should say he does mention Booth on more than one occasion, and the context of the speeches suggest he refers to him very often. So there we are. So the impetus for bringing in old age pensions, why 1906? There's a range of reasons. One I've mentioned, the almost universal recognition of the shortcoming of the poor law. Second one was the problems of the Boer War. People were deeply shocked, and you get right-wing people wanting welfare because of the unfitness of volunteers for the British Army. The most famous figures are for Manchester, where out of every 10 men going to volunteer, 7 were dismissed outright as unfit. 2 were only fit for the reserves, and only 1 out of every 10 could be accepted. And this was obviously something rotten at the heart of empire, and you get the inevitable comparisons with Rome crumbling from within, and will the British Empire go the same kind of way? A third thing I think about this is about efficiency in other ways. It's not just physical efficiency, it's about whether Britain can compete. You get these shock horror books. And this, get yourself ready for this shock horror title, Made in Germany. In other words, that you get accounts where German steel is not just as good as British, but it's better, and worse still, it's cheaper. So you're getting this kind of shock horror, and so you're getting businessmen saying, we actually need a fit population who will be able to work effectively. Obviously, old age pensions is not in the thick of that point, but it was one that was there in pushing forward some of these reforms. Another one which I think was very important was the growth of the labour movement. The working class had increasingly had the vote with the 1884 Reform Act. Late 1880s, the working class are involved in local government. They win seats and whole councils eventually in parts of London. The area I lived in at one time, Battersea, goes first of all to independent type of Labour, and then it's Labour Party Labour, and eventually you end up with Sackler-Vala as a communist in the 20s. But there is this kind of movement there, and of course it's also marked in this period by new unionism, where trade unionism spreads to the unskilled workers. And it was the unskilled workers who were the ones who first lost their job when there was a recession, and who were not likely to save for old age, who were not thrifty like the artisans in the skilled unions, because they probably didn't have the money, but they may have had different social styles, lifestyles. And these people, again, are pressing. So, again, the working class are less likely to accept the workhouse system. And in the 1906 Liberal landslide, promises to do something about the toughness of the workhouse system are high amongst Liberal manifestos. The other thing which I think is crucial is another effect of the Boer War. And that is that the cost of the Boer War took money that the British state might have put in pensions. Lloyd George, speaking in Flint in 1899, at the end of the year, said every Lyddite shell that was shot cost as much as an old age pension for 2 men for a whole year. One battle blazed away in shot and shell and destruction, 50,000 old age pensions. And later, Arthur Balfour, Conservative Prime Minister, 1902-5, acknowledged that it was the Boer War which had stopped the Conservatives really thinking about this. So you find, you know, that the Liberal victory in 1906, I think, moves this forward. The Liberals were far more likely to act anyway. The Liberals also had been in a bit of a quagmire. They'd last had a big victory in 1880. They had been in office 1892-5, but not much had happened. So the Liberals were likely to do something, but it's interesting that if you follow the 1906 election, look at A.K. Russell's book on it, you'll find that somewhere between 75 and 98% of Liberal candidates mentioned tariffs, Chinese slavery in South Africa, opposing the Tory Education Act, opposing the Tory licensing bill. And it's after those that you drop down, and the only one of the Liberal social reforms which gets mentioned, that is old age pensions. and something like 69% of the Liberal candidates mentioned that one. So that one is there, unlike the later things which emerge as the government goes on. And the thing that is there, I think, is the fact that the Liberals in office soon start to want to balance something for the working class. They're doing trade union reform, reversing Taff Vale. In this, they're pleasing the Labour Party, which at this time was really an auxiliary of the Liberals and made up primarily of male-skilled trade unionists, very much so. But they balance this. They're doing something for the trade unionists, so they want to do something for the non-organised working class. And it's this balance which I think pushes forward old age pensions in 1908. In looking at why it comes into Britain, we all come up, just as I've done, with this list of British reasons. I've been teaching British history of this kind for 38 years in universities, and the more I look at it, the more I think you've got to be comparative. You have to look wider, and this goes particularly with industrial relations. But if you look at the wider picture, you find one of the most famous books of recent times was Corelli Barnett, The Audit of War. If you read that, Barnett goes almost berserk over the welfare state and talks about, you know, these pampered people clinging to the nipples of the welfare state, which ruins the British people. Obviously, Corelli Barnett never looked beyond Britain, because if he did, he would find welfare measures in our competitors. If he actually did the arithmetic on it, he would find that the proportion of money spent on welfare as a proportion of GDP was actually higher in the countries which he's bewailing leaving Britain behind. And again, you get back to the point I made earlier, you may actually have a healthier workforce if they're not riddled with illness. So again, I think the answer for looking at why it happens in Britain, part of it is because it's happening everywhere. It's a response to urbanisation and industrialisation. Britain is fairly late along the line of countries doing this type of thing, and probably the latest that I'm aware of the main countries, is Tsarist Russia, which in 1912 does something of this kind, but very much more moderate. So we're not in happy company being towards the end of the line. I'm sure time is running out, so let me be very fast on the measure itself. The 1909 pension was not contributory. As I've said before, this would rule out those in most need. Secondly, it was experimental. I think the government only went so far because it wanted to see what the impact was on the deserving elderly poor, and I emphasise deserving. Thirdly, it was limited by age and income because it was something of a leap in the dark. Lloyd George, if you read these debates, as I said earlier, is more or less saying to the Conservatives repeatedly, you want to make it not 70 but 65. You never funded it when you were in office, and you're really trying to overballast the ship, was the phrase he uses. He has another interjection. I think it's a conservative gets up and says, oh, this is all very well, you want to do this for the elderly, but what about the worst cases of poverty when the man is ill and he has a wife and children and they all end up in the workhouse? And you can see Lloyd George in his feet say, yes, you've got a point. And he says, well, I'll think about that, I take your point. And I think this is the germination, or at least one of the germinations, of the road to national insurance, the most important and the most innovative of the Liberal reforms. If you look at the second of those handouts I gave, you've got a bit of Lloyd George's speech at the end of a few of my comments, where you can see Lloyd George recognising that point. The measure itself paid out 5 shillings a week. Now, everybody in the room who remembers 5 shillings as 25p will think that's not much. But it wasn't much then. It was there's a famous book called Round About a Pound a Week is What You Needed to Live On. So if you're being given 5 shillings, that tells you something, that this is not about giving people enough to live on. It is an aid to assist the thrifty. In other words, you're only going to benefit if you're A, not geriatric, because if you are geriatric, you'll be in the workhouse anyway, and B, that you have some other source of income. So again, it has this morality. The other thing you have to be is a UK citizen for 20 years. So you're not going to give it to some, shall we hatefully say, East End Jewish immigrant, which was, of course, the Daily Mail issue of the day. You know, these dreadful Jews coming into the East. I think we've heard that one in recent times. So that's not news. C, you've got to have an income not exceeding £26 a week. Again, this was not a high amount, but it was still a lot for women who were elderly and reliant on themselves. So you find, therefore, it did not solve and could not solve geriatric old age poverty, but it did save a lot of people from outrelief. Now, outrelief are not the ladies on the front page of my handout, but it's the people who got a little subsidy from the work, from the poor law system to live outside in their own homes. And the drop in outrelief from the coming in of pensions to before the First World War is a mind-boggling 95% drop. The numbers who were going to poor relief for this dropped by 95%. I think the figures are on my handout. So it did have that kind of impact. The issue lurking behind all this is the old Victorian one of thrift and self-reliance. Joseph Chamberlain, when he spoke against non-contributory pensions, i.e. ones which were free handouts, he was quite explicit. He said a non-contributory scheme might lead to a reintroduction of all the evils against which the poor law is supposed to guard us. In other words, this was the slippery slope where people, you know, will kind of run amok, you know, when they get this money. There are some figures now which I'm afraid you'll find amusing. I'm afraid I'll find amusing, but I'm sure I shouldn't. So I'll explain them. When these came in 1910, they looked at the take-up of the pensions. And in England and Wales, there were 411,000-odd people. And these were probably 44.7% of all over 70. In Scotland, there were 76,889, which was 53.8%. When you get to Ireland, you find the recipients were 180,974, and this was 98.6% of everyone over 70, which would suggest, if it was correct in the way it had been administered, that only 1.4% of anyone over 70 wasn't in need of assistance. And it also would suggest that no one in Ireland was on poor relief, because they would have been ineligible. So what happened? Well, the answer is our good friend statistics, which I'm sure many of us hate to hear about. But the registration of births, deaths and marriages came in 1865 in Ireland. It came in England and Wales in 1836. 1836 plus 70, by my maths, comes to 1906, which equals happiness for this. 1865 plus 70 equals unhappiness, because you haven't got the statistics. Most of Ireland was Catholic, so there weren't the Anglican registers. The Catholic churches are allegedly very poor. So how did they sort out the pension? The answer was that you turned up, and you said, I believe I should have a pension. They said, well, how old are you? And they say, 70. How do you know? My mother told me I was born in the year of the big wind, and there was a big gale. So if you turned up and said you were born that year, you got your pension. The Lloyd George said, part of the explanation, and he was sympathetic, he said, well, the facts as to poverty in Ireland are perfectly horrifying, so good luck to them, more or less. Several of the other liberal figures, well, the Irish poor really need help. But Augustine Birrell, who was the Secretary of State for Ireland, in his autobiography records, Tim Joyce told me, quote, I always thought I was 60, But my friends came to me and told me they were sure I was 70. And as there were four or five of them against me, the evidence was too strong for me. So I went and I got my pension. So that's, you know, the kind of story which came out of it. I mean, ironically, you find one or two unionist politicians said, wonderful, because this will make the Irish poor vote for staying in the union and against home rule. But whatever, there were that kind of problems. Anyway, let me conclude pretty well by saying the thing about the liberal reforms was they were not a welfare state. They only dealt with certain things. The key words are they were piecemeal and ad hoc. They dealt with bits and pieces. Different people were covered by different things, i.e. one of the insurance bills only covers certain occupational groups, that's the unemployment. The other one covers another group, and indeed you'd be better to lose your job and go ill than just lose your job in terms of the payments made out. So they were ad hoc. The other thing, I think, is that one needs to put them in this economic context I started with. You find that the Liberals did know what they were doing, or they thought, at least they were fairly confident they did. And you get the quotation, which I've got on the second of the handouts, from Churchill. Quote, "I do not want to impair the vigour of competition, but we can do much better to mitigate the consequence of failure. We want to draw a line below which we will not allow persons to live and labour, which they may, yet above which they may compete with all the strength of their manhood." So in other words, that these were to help people in a free market competitive economy. It was not a kind of socialist state type of thing. The other comment is that what was the motivation of the Liberals? I think most of it was altruistic. I think it was with Lloyd George. But even Lloyd George, perhaps as he was trying to sell the scheme to other people, came out with a comment which was to the effect that that in Germany the biggest blow that Bismarck struck against socialism was not repressive legislation, but was social welfare legislation. This was Lloyd George explicitly saying that this was the way to block socialism in Britain. As I say, I'm not sure he totally believed it. I think there was altruism on his part. So you reach, therefore, the old age pensions as the first of these measures. It's the one which is the most generous in the sense that it comes out of the exchequer, something that the Labour Party wanted all of the measures to be paid from. And then you come to what happened next. The answer is the First World War had massive inflation through 1915 to 20, and pensions go from 5 shillings to 7 and 6, still inadequate. By 1925, 1 million people are getting pensions. 70% are women again. You come to the Second World War and you have the People's War, and you do get the Beveridge Plan and the plan to provide welfare for all, cradle to the grave. And from 1925, under Churchill and the Conservatives, you have contributory pensions, i.e. you don't get them free, you're putting them into an old age insurance scheme. And of course, with Beveridge, you then have universal coverage of old age, as you do with the other things. So 1909 is the start of this, and I think it's a very interesting story. Thank you for listening.